21st century currency. Holmes's building and land were valuable to begin with, given Englewood's continued growth, but now his property seemed the equivalent of a seam of gold ore. An idea came to him for a way to mine that ore and also satisfy his other needs. He placed a new advertisement seeking more construction workers and once again called for the help of his loyal associates, Chapel, Quinlan, and Pitizel. Pilgrimage. On Monday evening, December 15th, 1890, a day noteworthy in Chicago for its extraordinary warmth and elsewhere for the gunshot death of Sitting Bull, Daniel Burnham stepped aboard a train bound for New York and what he knew would be the most crucial encounter of the Exposition Odyssey. He entered a bright green coach, one of George Pullman's palace cars, where the air hung with the stillness of a heavy tapestry. A bell clanged and continued clanging in a swinging rhythm as the train surged at grade level into the heart of the city at 20 miles an hour, despite the presence at arm's reach of grip cars, carriages, and pedestrians. Everyone on the street paused to watch as the train leapt past crossing gates, waving a raccoon's tail of white and black smoke. The train clicked by the Union Stockyard, doubly pungent in the day's strange warmth, and skirted sierras of black coal capped with grimy melting snow. Burnham treasured beauty, but saw none for miles and miles and miles, just coal, rust, and smoke, in endless repetition until the train entered the prairie and everything seemed to go quiet. Darkness fell, leaving a false twilight of old snow. The exposition director's decision on where to locate the fair had caused a rapid acceleration of event that was encouraging but also unsettling, because suddenly the whole thing had become more real, its true magnitude more daunting. Immediately, the directors had ordered a rough plan of the fair to be delivered to them within 24 hours. John Root, guided by Burnham and Olmsted, had produced a drawing on a sheet of brown paper measuring 40 square feet, which the men delivered to the committee with a barbed aside to the effect that the designers of the Paris Exposition had been able to spend a whole year thinking, planning, and sketching before reaching the same point. The drawing envisioned a mile-square plain on the lakeshore sculpted by dredges into a wonderland of lagoons and canals. Ultimately, the designers knew, the exposition would have hundreds of buildings, including one for each state of the Union and for many countries and industries. But on the drawing, they included only the five most important, each an immense palace sited around a central grand court. They also made room for a great tower to be built at one end of the court, although no one knew exactly who would build this tower or what it would look like, only that it would have to surpass Eiffel's tower in every way. The directors and their federal overseers, the National Commission, approved the plan with uncharacteristic speed. For outsiders, it was the sheer size of the exposition that made it seem such an impossible challenge. That the fair's grounds would be vast and its buildings colossal was something every Chicago resident took for granted. What mystified them was how anyone could expect to build the biggest thing ever constructed on American soil, far bigger than Roebling's Brooklyn Bridge, in so little time. Burnham knew, however, that the fair's size was just one element of the challenge. The gross features of the fair envisioned in the plan concealed a billion smaller obstacles that the public and most of the exposition's own directors had no idea existed. Burnham would have to build a railroad within the fairgrounds to transport steel, stone, and lumber to each construction site. He would have to manage the delivery of supplies, goods, mail, and all exhibit articles sent to the grounds by transcontinental shipping companies, foremost among them the Adams Express Company. He would need a police force and a fire department, a hospital and an ambulance service. And there would be horses, thousands of them. Something would have to be done about the tons of manure generated each day. Immediately after the Brown Paper Plan received approval, Burnham requested authority to build, at once, cheap wooden quarters in Jackson Park for myself and Force, quarters in which he would live almost continuously for the next 3 years. This lodging quickly became known as the Shanty, though it had a large fireplace and an excellent wine cellar stocked by Burnham himself. With an appreciation of the power of perception that far outpaced his era, Burnham recognized that the tiniest details would shape the way people judged the exposition. His vigilance extended even to the design of the fair's official seal. "It may not occur to you how very important a matter this seal is," he wrote in a December 8, 1890 letter to George R. Davis, the fair's director general, its chief political officer. "It will be very largely distributed throughout foreign countries and is one of those trivial things by which these people will judge the artistic standard of the fair." All these, however, were mere distractions compared to the single most important task on Burnham's roster, the selection of architects to design the fair's major buildings. He and John Root had considered designing the whole exposition themselves, and indeed their peers jealously expected they would do so. Harriet Monroe, Root's sister-in-law, recalled how one evening Root came home cut to the quick, because an architect whom he had considered a friend had apparently refused to recognize Mr. Burnham when they met at a club. Root grumbled, "I suppose he thinks we are going to hog it all." He resolved that to preserve his credibility as supervising architect, a role in which he would be compelled to oversee the work of other exposition architects, he would not himself design any of the buildings. Burnham knew exactly whom he wanted to hire, but was less aware of how incendiary his selections would prove. He wanted the best architects America had to offer, not just for their talent, but also for how their affiliation instantly would shatter the persistent Eastern belief that Chicago would produce only a country fair. In December, though he lacked an official mandate to do so, Burnham secretly mailed inquiries to 5 men, feeling confident that I would carry my point. And indeed, soon afterward, the Fair's Grounds and Buildings Committee authorized him to invite the men to join the exposition. Unquestionably, they were 5 of the greatest architects America had produced. But of the 5, 3 were from the land of unclean beasts itself. George B. Post, Charles McKim, and Richard M. Hunt, the nation's most venerable architect. The others were Robert Peabody of Boston and Henry Van Brunt, Kansas City. None was from Chicago, even though the city took great pride in its architectural pioneers, in Sullivan, Adler, Jenny, Beeman, Cobb, and the others. Somehow, despite his powers of anticipation, Burnham failed to realize that Chicago might see his choices as betrayal. What troubled Burnham at the moment, as he rode in his Pullman compartment, was the fact that only one of his candidates, Van Brunt of Kansas City, had replied with any enthusiasm. The others expressed only a tepid willingness to meet once Burnham arrived in New York. Burnham had asked Olmsted to join him for the meeting, aware that in New York, Olmsted's reputation exerted a force like gravity, but Olmsted could not get away. Now Burnham faced the prospect of having to go alone to meet these legendary architects. One of them, Hunt, a man also of legendary irascibility. Why were they so unenthusiastic? How would they react to his attempts at persuasion? And if they declined, and word of their refusal became public, what then? The landscape outside his windows gave him little solace. As his train roared across Indiana, it overtook a cold front. Temperatures plunged. Strong gusts of wind buffeted the train, and ghostly verga of ice followed it through the night. There were things Burnham did not know. That soon after receiving his letter, the Eastern architects, Hunt, Post, Peabody, and McKim, had held a meeting of their own in the offices of McKim, Meade, and White in New York to discuss whether the fair would be anything more than a display of overfed cattle. During the meeting, Hunt, the architect Burnham most hoped to recruit, announced he would not participate. George Post persuaded him at least to hear what Burnham had to say, arguing that if Hunt stood down, the others would feel pressed to do likewise, for such was Hunt's influence. McKim had opened this meeting with a wandering talk about the fair and its prospects. Hunt cut him off. "McKim, damn your preambles. Get down to facts." In New York, the wind blew hard and harsh all week. On the Hudson, ice produced the earliest halt to navigation since 1880. Over breakfast at his hotel on Thursday morning, Burnham read with uneasiness about the failure of S.A. Keene and Company, a private bank in Chicago. It was one more sign of a gathering panic. Burnham met the Eastern Architects Monday evening, December 22nd, at the Players Club for dinner. Their cheeks were red from the cold. They shook hands. Hunt, McKim, Post, and Peabody. Peabody, down from Boston for the meeting. Here they were, gathered at one table, the nation's foremost practitioners of what Goethe called frozen music. All were wealthy and at the peaks of their careers, but all also bore the scars of a 19th-century life, their pasts full of wrecked rail cars, fevers, and the premature deaths of loved ones. Especially Charles Folan McKim, Charming Charlie. He was bald, strong, ambidextrous, an expert skater and ballplayer. Deep, crinkly deltas at the corners of his eyes testified to his love of humor and his earthy, often deployed wit. On October 1, 1874, he had married a Boston socialite, Annie Bigelow, for her beauty and talent as a musician, but apparently for little else. She left him 4 years later and took their 3-year-old daughter back to Boston. He did not see the girl for the next 17 years. He married again on June 25, 1885, this time for love. Her name was Julia Appleton. On their honeymoon, he learned of the death of partner Stanford White's first child. A year and a half later, Julia died abruptly in their New York home. McKim wore their wedding ring on his left pinky and, in times of stress or sorrow, absent-mindedly touched its twin interlocking hearts. He did not remarry. The Eastern Architects wore dark suits and crisp white collars. All had mustaches, some dark, some gray. Post was huge, the largest man in the room. Hunt was fierce, a frown in a suit, with a client list that included most of America's richest families. Every other mansion in Newport, Rhode Island, and along Fifth Avenue in New York seemed to have been designed by him. But he also had built the base for the Statue of Liberty and was a founder of the American Institute of Architects. All the men had one or more elements of shared background. Hunt, McKim, and Peabody each had studied at L'École des Beaux-Arts in Paris. Van Brunt and Post had studied under Hunt. Van Brunt had been Peabody's mentor. For Burnham, with his failed attempts at getting into Harvard and Yale and his lack of formal architectural training, sitting down to dinner with these men was like being a stranger at someone else's Thanksgiving. The men were cordial. Burnham described his vision of a fair larger and grander than the Paris Exposition. He played up the fact of Olmsted's participation. Both Olmsted and Hunt were hard at work on George Washington Vanderbilt's manor, Biltmore, near Asheville, North Carolina, and together had built the Vanderbilt family's mausoleum. But Hunt was skeptical and not shy about expressing his doubts. Why should he and the others interrupt their already full schedules to build temporary structures in a far-off city where they would have little control over the final product? Their skepticism shook Burnham. He was accustomed to the headlong civic energy of Chicago. He wished Olmsted and Root were beside him. Olmsted to counter Hunt, Root because of his wit, And because the other architect all knew him from his role as secretary of the American Institute of Architects. Ordinarily, it was in situations like this that Burnham could be most effective. To himself, and indeed to most of the world in general, he was always right, wrote Harriet Monroe. And by knowing this so securely, he built up the sheer power of personality which accomplished big things. But this night, he felt ill at ease, a choir boy among cardinals. He argued that Chicago's fair, unlike any other before it, would be primarily a monument to architecture. It would awaken the nation to the power of architecture to conjure beauty from stone and steel. Olmsted's plans alone would make the exposition unique, with lagoons, canals, and great lawns all set against the cobalt blue steppe of Lake Michigan. In exhibit space, he told them, the fair would be at least one-third larger than what the French had allotted in Paris. This was no mere dream, he said. Chicago had the resolve to make this exposition a reality, the same resolve that had made the city the second largest in America. And, he added, it had the money. The architect's questions became slightly less challenging, more practical. What kind of structures did he envision, and in what style? The issue of the Eiffel Tower arose. What could Chicago do to equal that? On this score, Burnham had no plan other than somehow to surpass Eiffel. Secretly, he was disappointed that the engineers of America had not yet stepped forward with some novel but feasible scheme to eclipse Eiffel's achievement. The architects worried that anyone who joined the fair would find himself in the grip of innumerable committees. Burnham guaranteed complete artistic independence. They wanted to know in detail how Olmsted felt about the sites selected for the fair, in particular about a central feature called the Wooded Island. Their insistence prompted Burnham to telegraph Olmsted immediately and urge him once again to come. Again, Olmsted demurred. One question came up repeatedly throughout the evening. Was there enough time? Burnham assured them that ample time remained, but that he had no illusions. The work had to start at once. He believed he had won them. As the evening ended, he asked, would they join? There was a pause. Burnham left New York the next morning on the North Shore Limited. Throughout the day, his train pushed through a landscape scoured by snow as a blizzard whitened the nation in a swath from the Atlantic to Minnesota. The storm destroyed buildings, broke trees, and killed a man in Beaverton, Ohio, but did not stop the Limited. While aboard the train, Burnham wrote a letter to Olmsted that contained a less than candid description of the meeting with the architects. They all approved the proposition to have them take hold of the artistic part of the main buildings. The general layout seemed to meet the hearty approval first of Mr. Hunt, then of the others, but they were desirous of knowing your views of the landscape on and about the island. Therefore, I telegraphed you urgently to come. They were very much disappointed, as was I, when it was found impossible to get you. The gentlemen are all to be here on the 10th of next month, and at that time they urgently request, as do I, that you will be here personally. I find that Mr. Hunt especially lays large stress upon your opinions in the entire matter. In fact, the evening had ended rather differently. At the Players' Club, sips of cognac and exhalations of smoke had filled that last difficult pause. The dream was an appealing one, the architects agreed, and no one doubted Chicago's sincerity in imagining this fantasy precinct of lagoons and palaces, but the reality was something else entirely. The only real certainty was the disruption caused by long-distance travel and the myriad other difficulties inherent in building a complex structure far from home. Peabody did commit to the fair, but Hunt and the others did not. They said, as Burnham later revealed, they would think it over. They did, however, agree to come to the January 10th meeting in Chicago to confer again and examine the chosen ground. None of the architects had been to Jackson Park. In its raw state, Burnham knew it was not a setting likely to win anyone's heart. This time Olmsted had to be present. In the meantime, Root, too, would have to become involved in the courtship. The architects respected him, but were leery of his powers as supervising architect. It was critical that he go to New York. Outside, the sky was blank, the light pewter. Despite Pullman's vestibules, ice as fine as dust settled between coaches and filled Burnham's train with the tang of deep winter. Wind-felled trees appeared beside the railbed. Daniel Burnham arrived in Chicago to find the city's architects and members of the exposition board outraged that he had gone outside the city, to New York of all godforsaken places, to court architects for the fair, that he had snubbed the likes of Adler, Sullivan, and Jenny. Sullivan saw it as a sign that Burnham did not truly believe Chicago had the talent to carry the fair by itself. Burnham had believed that he might best serve his country by placing all of the work exclusively with Eastern architects, Sullivan wrote. Solely, he averred, on account of their surpassing culture. The chairman of the Grounds and Buildings Committee was Edward T. Jeffrey. With exquisite delicacy and tact, Sullivan said, Jeffrey, at a meeting of the committee, persuaded Daniel come to judgment to add the Western men to the list of his nominations. Hastily, Root and Burnham conferred and chose 5 Chicago firms to join the effort, among them Adler and Sullivan. Burnham visited each the next day. 4 of the 5 put aside their hurt feelings and accepted immediately. Only Adler and Sullivan resisted. Adler was sulking. I think he, Adler, had hoped to be in the position I was in, Burnham said. He was rather disgruntled and did not know. Now it was Root's turn to go to New York. He had to go anyway to attend a meeting of the directors of the American Institute of Architects, and planned afterward to take a train to Atlanta to inspect one of the firm's buildings. Root was in his office at the Rookery on the afternoon of New Year's Day, 1891, shortly before his departure, when an employee stopped by to see him. He said he was tired, the man recalled, and felt inclined to resign the secretaryship of the Institute. This was alarming, as he had never been heard to complain of too much work, and while it only indicated extreme physical exhaustion, and before he went home he became cheerful and hopeful again, it has its significance in the light of subsequent events. In New York, Root assured the architects again and again that he would do nothing to interfere with their designs. Despite his charm, the Chicago Inter-Ocean once called him another Chauncey M. Depew in postprandial wit and humor. He failed to arouse their enthusiasm and left New York for Atlanta, feeling the same degree of disappointment Burnham had felt 2 weeks earlier. His journey south did little to cheer him up. Harriet Monroe saw him upon his return to Chicago. He was depressed, she said, by the attitude of the Eastern men, whom he found singularly apathetic, utterly incredulous that any association of Western businessmen would give art a free hand in the manner he set forth. The dream was too extravagant ever to be realized, and they were extremely reluctant to undertake its realization against the hampering and tampering, the interferences petty and great, which they felt were certain to ensue. Root was tired and discouraged. He told Monroe he just could not get the men interested. He felt that this was the greatest opportunity ever offered to his profession in this country, and he could not make them appreciate it, she said. The architects did plan to come to Chicago for the January meeting, he told her, but reluctantly. Their hearts were not in it. On January 5th, 1891, the Committee on Grounds and Buildings authorized Burnham to offer formal commissions to all 10 architects and pay each $10,000, equivalent today to about $300,000. It was a rich fee, considering that all Burnham wanted them to do was provide working drawings and make a few visits to Chicago. Burnham and Root would see to the construction of the buildings and manage the niggling details that typically haunted an architect's life. There would be no artistic interference. The Eastern men gave their tentative acceptance, but their concerns had not diminished. And they still had not seen Jackson Park. A hotel for the fair. Holmes's new idea was to turn his building into a hotel for visitors to the World's Columbian Exposition. No Palmer House or Richelieu, certainly, but just comfortable enough and cheap enough to lure a certain kind of clientele, and convincing enough to justify a large fire insurance policy. After the fair, he intended to burn the building to collect the insurance, and, as a happy dividend, destroy whatever surplus material might remain in its hidden storage chambers. Although ideally, given other disposal measures available to him, the building by then would contain nothing of an incriminating nature. The thing is, one never knew. In the most transcendent moments, it was easy to make mistakes and forget some little thing that a clever detective might eventually use to propel him to the gallows. Whether the Chicago police even possessed that kind of talent was open to question. The Pinkerton National Detective Agency was the more dangerous entity, but its operatives of late seemed to be spending most of their energy battling strikers at coal fields and steel mills and rail yards around the country. Again acting as his own architect, Holmes early in 1891 began planning the necessary modifications, and soon carpenters were at work on the second and third floors. Once again, Holmes's method of segregating tasks and firing workers was proving successful. Clearly, none of the workers had gone to the police. Patrolmen from the new Chicago Police Precinct House on Wentworth walked past Holmes's building each day. Far from being suspicious, the officers had become friendly, even protective. Holmes knew each by name. A cup of coffee, a free meal in his restaurant, a fine black cigar. Policemen valued these gestures of affinity and grace. Holmes was, however, beginning to feel mounting pressure from creditors, in particular from several furniture and bicycle dealers. He could still charm them and commiserate over their inability to locate the elusive deed holder, H.S. Campbell, but Holmes knew they soon would lose patience, and in fact was a bit surprised that they had not pursued him more forcefully than had been the case thus far. His techniques were too new, his skills too great, the men around him too naive, as if they had never before experienced a falsehood. For every business that now refused to sell him goods, there were a dozen more that fawned over him and accepted his notes endorsed by H.S. Campbell or secured by the assets of the Warner Glass Bending Company. When pressed, sensing that a particular creditor was on the verge of legal action, even violence, Holmes paid his bills in cash using money harvested from his own ventures, such as lease income from his apartments and stores, sales from his pharmacy, and the proceeds from his newest venture, a mail-order medicine company. In a parody of Aaron Montgomery Ward's fast-growing empire in central Chicago, Holmes had begun selling sham drugs that he guaranteed would cure alcoholism and baldness. He was always open to new financial opportunities, but especially now, since he knew that no matter how deftly he kept labor costs down, he still would have to pay for at least some of the transformation of his building. When Murta's great-uncle, Jonathan Belknap of Bigfoot Prairie, Illinois, came to Wilmette for a visit, that challenge suddenly seemed likely to resolve itself. Belknap was not a rich man, but he was well off. Holmes began appearing more frequently at the Wilmette house. He brought toys for Lucy, jewelry for Murta and her mother. He filled the house with love. Belknap had never met Holmes but knew all about his troubled marriage to Murta and was prepared to dislike the young doctor. On first meeting, he found Holmes far too smooth and self-assured for a man of so few years. He was struck, however, by how enthralled Murta seemed to be whenever Holmes was around, and how even Murta's mother, Belknap's niece by marriage, appeared to glow in Holmes's presence. After several more encounters, Belknap began to appreciate why Murta had fallen so thoroughly for the man. He was handsome and clean and dressed well, and spoke in fine sentences. His gaze was blue and forthright. In conversation, he listened with an intensity that was almost alarming, as if Belknap were the most fascinating man in the world, not just an elderly uncle visiting from Bigfoot Prairie. Belknap still did not like Holmes, but found his candor sufficiently disarming that when Holmes asked him to endorse a note for $2,500 to help cover the cost of a new house and will meet for himself and Murta, Belknap agreed. Holmes thanked him warmly. A new house, away from Murta's parents, might be all the couple needed to end their growing estrangement. Holmes promised to pay the money back as soon as his business affairs allowed. Holmes returned to Englewood and promptly forged Belknap's signature to a second note for the same amount, intending to use the proceeds for his hotel. On Holmes's next visit to Wilmeet, he invited Belknap to visit Englewood for a tour of his building and of the newly chosen site for the World's Columbian Exposition. Although Belknap had read much about the World's Fair and did want to see its future home, he did not relish the idea of spending a full day with Holmes. Holmes was charming and gracious, but there was something about him that made Belknap uneasy. He could not have defined it. Indeed, for the next several decades, alienists and their successors would find themselves hard-pressed to describe with any precision what it was about men like Holmes that could cause them to seem so warm and ingratiating, but that could also telegraph the vague sense that some important element of humanness was missing. At first, alienists described this condition as moral insanity, and those who exhibited the disorder as moral imbeciles. They later adopted the term psychopath, first used in the lay press as early as 1885 in William Stead's Pall Mall Gazette, which described it as a new malady and stated, "Beside his own person and his own interests, nothing is sacred to the psychopath." Half a century later, in his path-breaking book, The Mask of Sanity, Dr. Hervey Cleckley described the prototypical psychopath as a subtly constructed reflex machine which can mimic the human personality perfectly. So perfect is his reproduction of a whole and normal man that no one who examines him in a clinical setting can point out in scientific or objective terms why or how he is not real. People exhibiting this purest form of the disorder would become known in the jargon of psychiatry as Cleckley psychopaths. When Belknap refused Holmes's offer, Holmes seemed to crumble with hurt and disappointment. A tour was necessary, Holmes pleaded, if only to bolster his own sense of honor and demonstrate to Belknap that he really was a man of means, and that Belknap's note was as secure an investment as any man could make. Murta, too, looked crestfallen. Belknap gave in. During the train journey to Englewood, Holmes pointed out landmarks. The skyscrapers of the city, the Chicago River, the stockyards. Belknap found the stench overpowering, but Holmes seemed not to notice it. The men exited the train at Englewood Station. The town was alive with movement. Trains rumbled past every few minutes. Horse-drawn streetcars moved east and west along 63rd, amid a dense traffic of carriages and drays. Everywhere Belknap looked, some building was under construction. Soon the level of construction would increase even more as entrepreneurs prepared to cash in on the expected crush of exposition visitors. Holmes described his own plans. He took Belknap on a tour of his pharmacy, with its marble countertops and glass containers filled with wildly colored solutions, then took him up to the second floor, where he introduced him to the building's caretaker, Patrick Quinlan. Holmes walked Belknap through the building's many corridors and described how the place would look as a hotel. Belknap found it bleak and strange, with passages that struck off in unexpected directions. Holmes asked Belknap if he would like to see the roof and the construction already underway. Belknap declined, claiming falsely that he was too old a man to climb that many steps. Holmes promised stirring views of Englewood, perhaps even a glimpse of Jackson Park off to the east, where the buildings of the fair soon would begin to rise. Again, Belknap resisted, this time with more force. Holmes tried a different approach. He invited Belknap to spend the night in his building. At first, Belknap declined this offer as well, but feeling perhaps that he had been overly rude in avoiding the roof, he relented. After nightfall, Holmes led Belknap to a room on the second floor. Gas lamps had been installed at haphazard intervals along the corridor, leaving pockets of gloom whose borders shivered as Belknap and Holmes moved past. The room was furnished and comfortable enough, and overlooked the street, which was still reassuringly busy. As far as Belknap could tell, he and Holmes were by now the only occupants of the building. "When I went to bed," Belknap said, "I carefully locked the door." Soon the street sounds receded, leaving only the rumble of trains and the hollow clip-clop of an occasional horse. Belknap had difficulty sleeping. He stared at the ceiling, which was bathed in the shifting light of the street lamps below his window. Hours passed. "Presently," Belknap said, "I heard my door tried, and then a key was slipped into the lock." Belknap called out, asking who was at the door. The noise stopped. He held his breath and listened, and heard the sound of feet moving down the hall. He was certain that initially two men had been outside his door, but now one of them had left. He called again. This time a voice answered. Belknap recognized it as belonging to Patrick Quinlan, the caretaker. Quinlan wanted to come in. "I refused to open the door," Belknap said. He insisted for a time and then went away. Belknap lay awake the rest of the night. Soon afterward, he discovered Holmes's forgery. Holmes apologized, claiming a dire need for money, and was so persuasive and abject that even Belknap felt mollified, although his distrust of Holmes persisted. Much later, Belknap realized why Holmes had wanted so badly to show him the building's roof. "If I'd gone," Belknap said, "the forgery probably wouldn't have been discovered, because I wouldn't have been around to discover it." "But I didn't go," he said. "I'm afraid of heights." As carpenters and plasterers worked on his building, Holmes turned his attention to the creation of an important accessory. He sketched a number of possible designs, relying perhaps on past observations of similar equipment, then settled on a configuration that seemed likely to work. A large rectangular box of fireproof brick about 8 feet deep, 3 feet high, and 3 feet wide, encased within a second box of the same material, with the space between them heated by flames from an oil burner. The inner box would serve as an elongated kiln. Although he had never built a kiln before, he believed his design would generate temperatures extreme enough to incinerate anything within. That the kiln also be able to destroy any odors emanating from the interior box was singularly important. He planned to install the kiln in the basement and hired a bricklayer named Joseph E. Berkler to do the job. He told him he intended to use the kiln to produce and bend plate glass for his Warner Glass Bending Company. At Holmes's instructions, Berkler added a number of components made of iron. He worked quickly, and soon the kiln was ready for its first test. Holmes ignited the burner. There was a satisfying whoosh. A wave of warmth rolled from the chamber to the far walls of the basement. The scent of partially combusted oil suffused the air. But the test was disappointing. The box did not generate as much heat as he had hoped. He adjusted the burner and tried again, but achieved little improvement. He used the city directory to locate a furnace company and requested an appointment with an experienced man. He identified himself as the founder of Warner Glass. If, for some reason, officials of the furnace company felt moved to verify that Warner Glass existed, all they had to do was check the 1890 Englewood directory to find the company's listing, with Holmes named as proprietor. The manager of the furnace company, his name was never made public, decided to attend the matter personally and met Holmes at his building. He found a young, good-looking man, almost delicate, who conveyed an air of confidence and prosperity. He had striking blue eyes. His building was on the gloomy side, the construction obviously below the standards of structures rising elsewhere on 63rd, but it was well located in a community that clearly was booming. For so young a man to own most of a city block was itself an accomplishment. The manager followed Holmes to his second-floor office, and there, in the pleasant cross breeze from the corner windows, studied Holmes's drawings of his kiln. Holmes explained that he could not obtain the necessary amount of heat. The manager asked to see the apparatus. That wasn't necessary, Holmes said. He did not wish to trouble the manager, only to seek his advice, for which, of course, he would pay an appropriate fee. The furnace man insisted he could do nothing without actually examining the kiln. Holmes smiled. Of course. If the manager did not mind spending the extra time, he would be glad to show it to him. Holmes led his visitor down two to the first floor, and from there down another, darker flight to the basement. They entered a large rectangular cavern that ran the entire length of the block, interrupted only by beams and posts. In the shadows stood vats and barrels and mounds of dark matter, possibly soil. A long, narrow table with a steel top stood under a series of unlit lamps, and two worn leather cases rested nearby. The cellar had the look of a mine, the smell of a surgeon's suite. The furnace man examined the kiln. He saw that it contained an inner chamber of fire brick constructed in a manner that kept flames from reaching the interior, and noted the clever addition of two openings in the top of the inner box that would allow the flow of gases from the box into the surrounding flames, where these gases would then be consumed. It was an interesting design and seemed likely to work, although he did observe to himself that the shape of the kiln seemed unsuited to the task of bending glass. The inner box was too small to admit the broad panes now appearing in storefronts throughout the city. Otherwise, he noticed nothing unusual and foresaw no difficulty improving the kiln's operation. He returned with a work crew. The man installed a more powerful burner, which, once ignited, heated the kiln to 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit. Holmes seemed pleased. Only later did the furnace man recognize that the kiln's peculiar shape and extreme heat made it ideal for another, very different application. In fact, he said, the general plan of the furnace was not unlike that of a crematory for dead bodies, and with the provision already described, there would be absolutely no odor from the furnace. But again, that was later. Holmes's absences from Wilmeet lengthened once again, although at regular intervals he sent Murda and his daughter enough money to keep them comfortable. He even insured the girl's life, since children, after all, were such fragile things and could be taken from the world in a heartbeat. His businesses were doing well. His mail-order company brought in a surprising amount of cash, and he began trying to find a way to capitalize on the latest medical rage, a cure for alcoholism invented by a physician named Keeley in Dwight, Illinois. The corner drugstore ran smoothly and profitably, although one woman in the neighborhood observed that he seemed to have difficulty retaining the young and typically attractive women he often hired as clerks. These clerks, as far as she could tell, had an unfortunate habit of departing without warning, sometimes even leaving their personal belongings in their rooms on the second floor. She saw such behavior as a troubling sign of the rising shiftlessness of the age. The work of turning Holmes's building into a hotel proceeded slowly, with the usual bouts of rancor and delay. Holmes left the task of finding replacement workers to his three helpers, Quinlan, Chapel, and Pititzel. They seemed to have little difficulty finding new men for each new opening. Thousands of workers laid off elsewhere had come to Chicago hoping for jobs building the fair, only to find that too many workers had gotten the same idea, thus leaving a large pool of men available for work. Any work, at any price. Holmes turned his attention to other, more pleasant distractions. Sheer fate had brought two new women into his life, one of them nearly 6 feet tall and possessed of a rapturous body. The other, her sister-in-law, a lovely young woman with black hair and exquisite dark eyes. That the tall one came equipped with a husband and daughter only enhanced her appeal. It made the situation infinitely more appealing. The landscape of regret. The Eastern Architects left New Jersey at 4:50 p.m., January 8, 1891, in Car 5, Section 6 of the North Shore Limited, which Hunt had reserved so that all the architects could travel together. Olmsted had come down from Boston the night before in order to join them. It was a bewitching moment. A gorgeous train rocketing through the winter landscape carrying five of history's greatest architects, all in the same car, gossiping, joking, drinking, smoking. Olmsted used the opportunity to describe in detail Jackson Park and the trials of dealing with the exposition's many layers of committees that for the moment seemed to have so much power. He respected Burnham for his candor, directness, and the air of leadership he exuded, and no doubt told the architects as much. That he spent a good deal of time asserting his own vision of the exposition's landscape is also beyond doubt, especially his belief that the wooded island should remain entirely free of conspicuous man-made structures. 2 hours before the train reached Chicago, during a brief stop, McKim received a cable notifying him that his mother, Sarah McKim, had died unexpectedly in her home at 78. The two had been very close. He left the group and caught a return train. The architects arrived in Chicago late Friday night and took carriages to the Wellington Hotel, where Burnham had arranged rooms for all. Van Brunt, arriving from Kansas City, joined them there. The next morning they boarded carriages for the journey south to Jackson Park. Root, absent, was to return that day from Atlanta. The ride to the park took about an hour. It was one of those cold winter days, Burnham recalled. The sky was overcast with clouds and the lake covered with foam. At the park, the architects eased from the carriages, puffing blasts of steam into the frigid air. The wind picked up motes of sand which stung their cheeks and forced them to shield their eyes. They stumbled over the frozen ground, Hunt wincing from gout, cursing, disbelieving. Olmsted, his teeth inflamed, his night an ordeal of wakefulness, limping from his long-ago carriage accident. The lake was gray, darkening to a band of black at the horizon. The only color in the vicinity was the frost rouge on the men's cheeks and the blue of Burnham's and Olmsted's eyes. Olmsted watched for the architect's reactions. Now and then he and Burnham caught each other's glances. The architects were stunned. They gazed, Burnham said, with a feeling almost of despair. Jackson Park was 1 square mile of desolation, mostly treeless, save for pockets of various kinds of oak, bur, pin, black, and scarlet, rising from a tangled undergrowth of elder, wild plum, and willow. In the most exposed portions there was only sand, tufted with marine and prairie grasses. One writer called the park remote and repulsive, another a sandy waste of unredeemed and desert land. It was ugly, a landscape of last resort. Olmsted himself had said of Jackson Park, if a search had been made for the least park-like ground within miles of the city, nothing better meeting the requirement could have been found. In fact, the site was even worse than it appeared to the eye. Many of the oaks were dead. Given the season, the dead were hard to distinguish from the living. The root systems of others were badly damaged. Test borings showed the earth within the park consisted of a top layer of black soil about 1 foot thick, followed by 2 feet of sand, then 11 feet of sand so saturated with water, Burnham wrote, it became almost like quicksand and was often given this name. The Chicago men understood the challenge this soil presented. The New York men, accustomed to bedrock, did not. The park's gravest flaw, at least from Olmsted's perspective, was that its shoreline was subject to dramatic annual changes in the level of the lake, perhaps as much as 4 feet. Such fluctuations, Olmsted recognized, would greatly increase the difficulty of planting the banks and shores. If the water level fell, visitors to the fair would be treated to an offensive band of bare earth at the waterline. If it rose too high, the water would submerge and kill shore plantings. The architects climbed back into their carriages. They drove toward the lake over the park's rough roads at the pace of a funeral cortege, and with equal gloom. Burnham wrote, "A feeling of discouragement allied to hopelessness came over those who then first realized the extent and magnitude of the proposed undertaking, and appreciated the inexorable conditions of a time limitation to the work. 21 months later was the day fixed by Act of Congress for the dedication of the buildings, and in the short space of 27 1/2 months, or on May 1, 1893, the entire work of construction must be finished, the landscape perfected, and the exhibits installed." At the lake, they again left their carriages. Peabody of Boston climbed atop a pier. He turned to Burnham. "Do you mean to say that you really propose opening a fair here by 93? "Yes," Burnham said. "We intend to." Peabody said, "It can't be done." Burnham looked at him. "That point is settled," he said. But even he did not, and could not, grasp what truly lay ahead. Root returned to Chicago while the architects were in Jackson Park. It was his 41st birthday. He went directly from the train station to the rookery. He went down to the office in a gay humor, Harriet Monroe said, and that very day received a commission for a large commercial building. But that afternoon, draftsman Paul Sterrett encountered Root in one of the rookery's elevators, looking ill. His good spirits had fled. He complained again of being tired. The architects returned from their tour discouraged and full of regret. They gathered again in the firm's library, where Root, suddenly revitalized, now joined them. He was gracious, funny, warm. If anyone could sway these men and ignite their passion, Burnham knew, Root was the one. Root invited the outside men to come to his house on Astor Place the next day, Sunday, for high tea, then went home, at last, to greet his children and his wife, Dora, who, according to Harriet Monroe, was in bed, ill almost unto death, from a recent miscarriage. Root told Dora of his weariness and suggested that in the coming summer they should escape somewhere for a long rest. The last months had been full of frustration and long nights of work and travel. He was exhausted. The trip south had done nothing to ease his stress. He looked forward to the end of the week, to January 15th, when the architects would conclude their conference and go home. "After the 15th," he told his wife, "I shall not be so busy." The Eastern and Chicago architects reconvened that night at the University Club for a dinner in their honor, hosted by the Fair's Grounds and Buildings Committee. Root was too tired to attend. Clearly the dinner was a weapon meant to ignite enthusiasm and show the Easterners that Chicago fully intended to follow through on its grand boasts about the exposition. It was the first in a sequence of impossibly rich and voluminous banquets whose menus raised the question of whether any of the city's leading men could possibly have a functional artery. As the men arrived, reporters intercepted them. The architects were gracious, but close-mouthed. They sat at a large T-shaped table with Lyman Gage, president of the exposition, at the center of the topmost table, Hunt on his right, Olmsted on his left. Bundles of carnations and pink and red roses transformed the tables into cutting beds. A boutonniere rested beside each plate. Everyone wore tuxedos. There was not a woman in sight. At precisely 8 p.m., Gage took Hunt and Olmsted by the arm and led the way from the club's reception room to the banquet hall. Oysters. A glass or two of Montrachet. Consommé of green turtle. Amontillado. Broiled shad à la maréchale. Cucumbers. Potatoes à la duchesse. Filet mignon à la Rossini. Château Lafitte and Renard Brut. Fonds d'entrechaux farci. Pommerie sec. Sorbet au kirsch. Cigarettes. Woodcock on toast. Asparagus salad. Ices. Canton ginger. Cheeses. Pont l'Evêque. Roquefort. Coffee. Liqueurs. Madeira. 1815. Cigars. Gage spoke first. He offered a rousing oration on the brilliance of the future exposition and the need now for the great men in the banquet hall to think first of the fair, last of themselves. That only through the subordination of self would the exposition succeed. The applause was warm and enthusiastic. Burnham spoke next. He described his own vision of the fair and Chicago's resolve to make that vision real. He, too, urged teamwork and self-sacrifice. Gentlemen, he said, 1893 will be the third great date in our country's history. On the two others, 1776 and 1861, all true Americans served. And so now, I ask you to serve again. This time, the room erupted. The men left the banquet hall that night united like soldiers in a campaign, Burnham said. It was the Chicagoans, however, who did all the marching. At Root's house the next day, Harriet Monroe met the Eastern architects and came away shaken. In talking with them, I was amazed at their listless and hopeless attitude, she said. Beautiful effects were scarcely to be expected in buildings so enormous and so cheaply constructed. The level of monotony of ground surfaces in Chicago made effective grouping practically impossible. The time for preparation and construction was too short. These and other criticisms indicated a general feeling of disparagement. At tea's end, Root escorted the visitors to their carriages. It was dark and bitterly cold. A sharp wind scythed along Astor Place. Much was made in retrospect of the fact that Root, in evening dress, charged into the rock-cold night without first putting on a coat. Vanishing Point. After years spent drifting from town to town and job to job, a young jeweler named Icilius Connor, he preferred the nickname Ned, moved to Chicago with his wife Julia and their 8-year-old daughter Pearl, and quickly found that Chicago was indeed a city of opportunity. At the start of 1891, Ned found himself managing a jewelry counter that occupied one wall of a thriving drugstore on the city's south side, at 63rd and Wallace. For once in Ned's adult life, the future gleamed. The owner of the drugstore, though very young, was prosperous and dynamic, truly a man of the age, and seemed destined for even greater success, given that the World's Columbian Exposition was to be built just a short streetcar ride east at the end of 63rd. There was talk, too, that a newly elevated rail line, nicknamed the Alley L for the way its trestles roofed city alleys, would be extended eastward along 63rd directly to Jackson Park, thus providing visitors with another means of reaching the future fair. Already traffic on the street had increased sharply, as each day hundreds of citizens drove their carriages to the park to see the chosen sight. Not that there was much to see. Ned and Julia had found the park an ugly, desolate place of sandy ridges and half-dead oaks, although Pearl had enjoyed trying to catch tadpoles in its pools of stagnant water. That anything wonderful could rise on that ground seemed beyond possibility, Although Ned, like most new visitors to Chicago, was willing to concede that the city was a place unlike any he had encountered. If any city could make good on the elaborate boasts circulated thus far, Chicago was the one. Ned's new employer, Dr. H. H. Holmes, seemed a perfect example of what everyone called the Chicago spirit. To be so young, yet own a restaurant, barbershop, and drugstore, and the